Hello, you are listening to the Mobile Community Radio Show, and I am your host, Jenny, and this is CFRU 93.3 FM. That track you just heard was from my Golden Community Music Project, a project I did last summer in front of City Hall when I set up a bunch of instruments and let people from the community record songs together. It was a really interesting project, and I've been using those songs as the theme for my show. On today's show, I'm going to play my audio hangout with Michael Schimp, who's the volunteer coordinator for the Community Gardens with the Two Rivers Neighborhood Group, and Ryan Ritzkes, who works for the Two Rivers Neighborhood Groups. But before we go into that conversation, I'm going to play a track by CFRU's own Glacio de Fluvial. This is a song from a movie soundtrack from a film that was never made from him and his friend back in 1997. The project was called Niao de Du, and the song is called Petals of the Night. After that track, we're going to go straight into my conversation with Michael and Ryan. So here is Now to Do, Glacio de Fluvial, Petals of the Night.
And the devil only cries, has a heart of broken spokes. I wish mama was alive, for us to turn into a joke. A cry. I pedal down the dirty road. Now I'm looking for a ride, and my chain done gone and broke. I hear mama down inside, saying please and don't and no.
She's right. Tell me
everything she knows.
Are you still me a bike long ago? Petals of the
Oh,
We're here at the Two Rivers Neighborhood Group, Tytler Public School in the ward, and school has just begun, but the Two Rivers Community Group got to keep this room, which is super exciting. And I'm here with Ryan Ritzkus. I said that right?
Hi. Yeah, I'm Ryan Ritzkus.
Yep. And he's the...
Ryan Ritzkus.
He's the main guy here at Two Rivers?
Yeah. I'd say I'm the staff person. We have a crew of amazing volunteers who kind of steer the ship and make a lot of the stuff happen. But I'm the person that kind of helps pick up the pieces that are to keep things rolling. And one of our amazing volunteers that's also with the group is Michael Schimp, who coordinates our Lion Park Garden, and I was also one of the coordinators of our Huron Street Garden. So we have two community gardens here in the ward, and two very different gardens of different styles, but they're both amazing and offer different things to this community. Michael, would you like to describe what Lions Park Garden is for us?
Yeah, Lion Park Community Garden is a new community garden in Guelph, having begun just this very year in July, I think, early July. So it's a member-run and all-volunteer-operated community garden, meaning that community members are able to rent allotment plots with proceeds going back into the garden. And each plot is a 10 by 10 square where people are invited to grow vegetables and flowers and pull weeds and be a part of a fantastic community in our neighborhood, which is Ward 1 or St. Patrick's Ward in Guelph.
So an allotment garden, essentially, where people can rent a small plot for the year. Why would people want an allotment plot?
People choose allotment plots looking for a venue to grow their own food, to teach their kids how to grow food. Lots of our members are avid gardeners, or people maybe don't have enough sunlight in their home garden. And some people don't have a garden at all, like living in an apartment building or that kind of thing. People might want to have somewhere just to grow their own food.
Where you're situated at Lions Park, I kind of call it the beaches, where it's a lot of just this group of, freehold houses that have yards. Are close to the river, beautiful little section of land. A lot of young families are moving there or are there currently. And most of them have backyard space. So if they have that space in their backyard, but they still want to be involved in a community garden, what do you feel like it offers in that way?
I love that you call it the beaches, first of all, Ryan. I hope that catches that, on.
I hope it does too, and it has on a few people.
Well, again, I think it offers a sense of community and togetherness. So, people that are choose to be a part of a community garden tend to be people that want to meet like-minded people, share stories, share surplus food, share seeds. Each of us that grow different things, you might have a glut of tomatoes or zucchinis that you need help processing or something like that. And again, a lot of homeowners have things like trees and are shaded out by fences. Some people have dogs. So there is a number of reasons that a freehold homeowner may choose to be a part of a community garden as well.
Great. So it's been going on for 3 months now, essentially. You're wrapping up near the end of the season, kind of with start of school. Most people see that as kind of the end of gardening season, even though it's not. You can still grow for many months still. But there is a bit of a shift, mm-hmm. for sure. How would you say this first summer has gone then for you guys?
I would say it's been excellent. We've definitely had some challenges so far. We're still experiencing some challenges. Overall, it's been a fantastic year. We've had an amazing response. All of our plots are full. But, you know, we've had some challenges. You know, one of the biggest challenges being that some community members don't understand that these are member plots, that each person that operates a plot or is a part of our garden actually also gets to take home their produce. We had three adults caught red-handed helping themselves from all of the plots in the garden the other day. And thankfully, one of our members was there to inform them that this wasn't a grocery store and that it wasn't a free-for-all and that these are actually people's garden plots. So hopefully that, you know, as people learn that this is a...
These were random people coming by, or these were other gardeners that just were helping themselves to other people's plots?
These were random people in the neighborhood that apparently were very surprised that to learn that it isn't a free-for-all. They were under the impression that community garden means that community members can help themselves, which isn't the case. Anyone listening out there, community garden generally means that you volunteer, you pay some money, you get a plot, and then you get to reap the rewards. But out of that comes a lot of hard work, a lot of weeding, a lot of digging, and most community gardens have a volunteering requirement as well, where members are often required to volunteer at least some of their time throughout the season for garden projects, fence building, path mending, these kinds of things.
Gardening, though it has very strong therapeutic value, it is a lot of hard work.
It sure is.
And for someone as a gardener or a farmer to spend your whole summer growing vegetables and then, yeah, having someone just come and reap the harvest is definitely discouraging.
It's heartbreaking. I was there at the garden this morning and I had been sort of nurturing this little green acorn squash. And I was pretty excited about it and I found it gone this morning. So I
so
understand
more
that.
Theft.
I'm not sure if this was still the end result of the other day, people being caught. Maybe they had already taken it. Mm-hmm. It was a very good looking squash. It's heartening to know that somebody was eating it. You know that it's
hopefully as opposed to smashing it on someone's car.
That's right. Yeah, it's definitely more discouraging to find things that have just been smashed or picked underripe or whatever. Somebody had been watching this squash and picked it when it looked really good.
So, wrapping up this first year, you're going to move forward obviously and continue to build with the successes you've had. What's kind of stage two or version 2.0 of this garden? What's next?
We're building a fence. This is yeah, I guess that is really funny. From the beginning we expected to build a fence. We hoped that we would have less theft than we have had. But fence is the next step to let people know sort of passively that it's not a free-for-all. And also, of course, we have some animals like rabbits. I think rabbits are doing the most mammalian damage at the garden, aside from people. So those two reasons, to keep you know, sticky fingers and sticky paws out.
Do you know, for other community gardens in the city, do you know how many gardens there are, by chance?
I think there are 18 of them. I could be wrong, but there are way more than I knew before I started going to the garden meetings.
You
with
don't
the city.
See them very often.
No, they seem to be tucked into places. There's a number of them on school grounds and in parks. I think each neighborhood, each ward in Guelph has its own community garden.
That's amazing, at least one. Yep.
And now it could be wrong, but I think that's the case. I believe there are 18, and this year we've had at least two new gardens, which is fantastic, including this one at Lion Park.
Mm-hmm. Now, you're a man also that is able to look at the bigger picture and dream and vision. What do you think we need to do in the city to get more community gardens, to have more people excited about growing their own food, about going out and meeting people through work and through growing their own foods, through self-sufficiency?
That's a really good question, Ryan. I think the biggest challenge I've experienced in this coordinator role is finding volunteers that will come out and actually do the hard work. It's very easy to have eager members at the beginning that will sign up for a garden plot without really accepting how much hard work goes in, as you mentioned earlier. Gardening is wonderfully fun and very therapeutic, but it can be really challenging. At one of our ward gardens, the Two Rivers Garden at Huron in Manitoba, there's a lot of a plant called bindweed, which has almost single-handedly driven away many, many members. I think it's one of these plants that's called mile-a-minute vine as well. If it isn't, it should be. So bindweed, it's a vining, herbaceous perennial that looks something like morning glory. It has toony-sized, trumpet-like pink or purple flowers, sometimes white flowers. I guess they're more white or pink, rarely purple. And it strangles out other plants, and it grows very quickly. So it's easy to maintain if you're on top of it. You would just pull it at the soil level and continue pulling and pulling and pulling the plant. Eventually, over the course of several years, you will kill the plant. But you really have to be on top of it. And people often don't anticipate how often they'll need to tend their garden. So I think that's the single biggest factor, is finding volunteers that will come out, you know, three times a week.
So with all that hard work, like you have your own plot in this garden, but you're also going above and beyond that and coordinating the whole garden, but also other gardens, and you do this for a living. What keeps you motivated through all that? Because it's like you said, it's hard work. How can you put in so much more when someone else can't even take care of their own plot?
That's also a very good question, Ryan. Thank you for that. I really believe in community, and I am a natural gardener, meaning that it's something that I do kind of wherever I go. I've reclaimed laneways, and I plant trees in wild spaces, native trees in wild spaces. It's a big part of my life. So I think I don't really know how to answer that, Ryan. I like it. I like gardens. I like people. I'm really good at it, and it comes very naturally to me. And I believe that if each of us that has something that we're good at just does it, then the world becomes a much better place. Many of us are stuck in jobs that we don't like, doing things that we don't like, and we feel really stuck. But if we follow our passion and we follow that thing that really drives us, then we end up living in communities that are vibrant and beautiful and wonderful. And this is something that I do. I'm a good gardener, and I'm only okay at the coordinating part. But it's pretty easy for me to go around and make gardens in places and pull weeds and stuff. I mean, I have so much experience as well that weeding for me is really easy and natural. And for newer gardeners, it's a learning curve.
I really like what you said about it, like just being a source of community, and that we all have a spot to play. And if we follow our passions, it can make this our community a vibrant place. So much of it, I think, is that we settle for different things, whether it's for a job or, I don't know, a house, whatever we settle for, when really, instead of following our passions, whatever it is, whether that's pulling weeds or whether that is IT or whatever, if you follow your passions, that passion leaks out everywhere.
That's right. We all have different passions, eh? Some of us are really passionate about gardening. Some of us are really passionate about IT, as you say. And some of us don't want to do either of those things for work, and what we want is a job that we don't have to think about too much. Point is, if each of us are doing what really drives us, then that reverberates to the rest of the community. So, yeah, that's all I'm doing. Just jiving.
So what would you say to someone who wanted to be involved in a community garden? How would they go about doing that? And what would be your precautions?
I would say if you're living in Guelph, then get in touch with your neighborhood group, your representative from your neighborhood group. So in our Ward 1 neighborhood, you'd get in touch with Ryan Ritzkus. What's the email they would get to you?
Well, the neighborhood group in the ward is the Two Rivers neighborhood group. And I would just send them to the website, which I believe is tworiversng.ca.
You can also check out the city's website. There's a link for community gardens on there that will direct you further. And if you're living in a different city, then I would encourage you, pardon me, to check your city's website or to see if your neighborhood has a neighborhood association or neighborhood group, because it's... yeah, it's pretty great. You might find a pile of other resources as well that you're interested in by connecting with your neighborhood group. Mm-hmm. What was the other part of your question?
If a new gardener was interested in a community garden but didn't have the skills, what would be some of the precautions that you would maybe throw their way?
Oh, precautions. Well, I would say start by reading. Take a bunch of books out of the library. Ask people in your neighborhood who you notice are growing food. You know, ask a bunch of questions and talk to people first. You might be able to help somebody who's already volunteering at a community garden. You might be able to volunteer without actually becoming a member to meet people. We have an organization in Guelph called Transition Guelph. Transition Guelph has a whole pile of different programs that, you know, are related to sustainability and appropriate living. And there are many other transition cities out there that have similar programs.
Barreling down the road as I get around.
Welcome back. You are listening to the Mobile Community Radio Show on CFRU 93.3 FM. And that track you just heard was called Lazy Rain. That was by Claire Whitehead, and it was sent to me as per my request for home recordings and demos and B-sides. And I'm extending that to you, listeners. If you or your friends have songs you've recorded that haven't really made the radio airwaves, you can send them to mobile@cfru.ca with the subject Recorded Submission, and I will get it on the radio. Now we're going to go back into my audio hangout with Michael Schimp from the Community Gardens and Ryan Ritzkus from the Two Rivers Neighborhood Group. Here they are.
Cool. So in the ward, we also have another community garden, which is totally different than the allotment plot style. I've been starting to refer to it as the Huron Street Garden. How would you describe that garden and its uniqueness?
The garden that you're referring to.
The Huron Street Garden.
The Huron Street Garden that I would call the Two Rivers Garden.
Yes.
Because we're the Two Rivers neighborhood. So the ward, or St. Patrick's Ward, or Ward 1, all of these names we have is officially by the city of Guelph referred to as the Two Rivers neighborhood. So it's confusing, right? Mm-hmm. So this historic garden we have here has been there for many years. That was nicknamed Two Rivers Garden many years ago, so that it might be a thing that's hard to change.
Yeah.
But we actually have two gardens in our Two Rivers neighborhood now. So the garden at Huron in Manitoba is very different from the garden in Lion Park, because it has many large trees and a bunch of smaller and intermediate trees. It has an orchard area, flowering shrubs, tons of perennial flowers. Many of them are native. It's got a big shed on it, and it's been there for a long time. So it feels very grown in and established in a way that Lion Park is still really new, and it essentially looks like some squares cut into a field that people have planted their veggies in. So the look and feel of the gardens is really, really different.
Mm-hmm. The Huron Street I would describe much more as like an English style garden with shrubs and trees everywhere. So much diversity that even the most advanced gardener couldn't pick out half the things there. And overgrown with life. Even though the land itself, to the more advanced eye, you can see that it's abused. It's a rough piece of land that at one point was a quarry and then was backfilled with construction rubble, essentially.
Oh.
And then for many years, it was just the neighborhood abandoned lot that people would play baseball on or whatever. It's got a quite a slope, but essentially there's no fertility on the land until recently. We've been building it through trees and shrubs and whatnot, and just through general gardening practices. But you can see it, that's just, things don't grow extremely well there. There's several spots where it's actually still gravel on the top. There's no soil whatever still, but you can walk through it, and I'm amazed at its complexity and its beauty. There's several people in the neighborhood who find it too wild, but there's many people who are like, wow, this is like a little haven inside the city. And it's about, I would say it's about three plots, like three house lot sizes. So it's fairly big. But there's several different sections too. So there is a small allotment garden section, but there is, as Michael said, there's an orchard section, as well as a flower perhaps section, if you wanted to call it that, a pollinator section. We're also building a kids play area section, which I think is fascinating. And there's just kind of an open space in the middle that's always shaded even during the heat of the summer, where there's a couple picnic tables. So it's also a natural gathering space for some people. Where do you think that garden can grow, even though it has all that history behind it, and it's, like you said, it's more mature? Is there still somewhere for it to go, or has it come to its potential?
No, I think there's tons of potential at that Huron Street Garden site. It's a beautiful space. It's got a wonderful energy. It's a place in the ward for people to relax and to contemplate. So yeah, I would like to see more orchard trees planted, and as the trees get bigger, there will definitely be room for interplanting or creating what permaculturists call guilds of companion planting, or creating beyond companion planting, but creating communities of plants where you'd have several different species coexisting in a community situation. So people plants are supporting each other, and funny that I said people, plants, people, same. But no, in these guilds, plants would be supporting each other, or at least not interfering with each other's growth, and creating a much more productive area than, say, just having a tree alone. So we definitely see that as room for improvement. Mm-hmm. And some of the areas that we have there that exist, the raspberries, we've got grapevines, hops. There are several things that are really, really big and quite overgrown that could do with having, more modern management techniques, wires, structures to climb on, regular mowing in between. These kinds of things. But again, the issue we've had at that particular garden is having enough volunteers mm-hmm. come out and help. Regularly, Ryan and I on Thursdays go to the garden to do regular maintenance, to cut grass, to prune trees, to, pull weeds, this kind of thing. So that's been very effective this year in keeping it well maintained. More volunteers, please.
Right. So where an allotment plot garden where you sign up for the year, you grow your own vegetables, you reap your own harvest, your own vegetables. This garden at Huron Street is fantastic in that it allows people to kind of come in and come out really quickly in terms of volunteering. So you can come for a day or two, dig some weeds, plant some plants, prune whatever, but you don't have to be invested in it for like a whole season. Mm-hmm. So it's a great way to get your feet wet into gardening to see if, well, or maybe you just don't have the time. The summer is a tricky time. Maybe you're traveling, going on holidays. The Huron Street Garden is, it's shady, so it keeps you cool during the summer. But I love that you can kind of come and learn about different stuff without having to fully invest. That's where me and Michael have gone regularly, hoping that people would come and be like, I just kind of want to learn about gardening. Like, what do you do with raspberries? You got this whole raspberry patch. What do you do with it? Mm-hmm. Or what are all these plants? I don't know what they are. Like, can you teach me some things? So we're working on building that. So if any of the listeners here are like, wow, I would love to be involved with gardening, but I have no idea what I'm going to do. Come out on Thursdays, mm-hmm. Early afternoons.
Between 1 and 3, we'll probably be there until it snows.
We've had several kids be involved with the garden this year. And it's, from an adult perspective, I love seeing them in the garden because they engage in a totally different way. For us, it can seem on the borderline of work and play, whereas for a kid, it's all play. Mm-hmm. It's all excitement. It's all new things. And so whether they're learning about new plants that they've never seen before, or trying raspberries, or finding bugs in the garden, all it is excitement for them. And it's a safe space so that as a parent, you can let your kid just wander off or whatever and kind of explore on their own. But I've loved seeing their excitement and joy.
As have I, and to watch kids pick raspberries, not only to learn about them, but then to be able to pick them themselves, to eat apples fresh from the tree, mm-hmm. And to find secret spaces. We've got a couple of, places in the garden that are, like secret little gardens for them to find. It's thrilling.
Mm-hmm. That's the appeal to me of that one, more so than the sort of allotment plot mm-hmm. concept is like, as much as I love the idea of teaching my children the relationship of we put a seed and we tended this and then this is what grew. Like, I mean, down the road, I would love
to demonstrate that, but for the time being, the like exciting discovery of a fruit growing somewhere that a child wasn't expecting, or the foraging aspect is the one that my kids have gravitated to out of the absence of the other style, I guess. But we have fruit trees in our yard, and there's nothing more exciting to my kids than getting to go and pick the pears or pick the berries and or go to my friend Ryan's and like a different Ryan, but grab his cherries there's something very I don't like as a mother, something comes over me when I'm feeding my children, something that naturally occurred that I didn't make. Like, I feel like even if I grew it to some extent, it wouldn't be that different than baking them something or going to the grocery store and buying them something. But when we found it, there's some weird, I don't know, like if it's like a throwback to the foraging days of being like a cave woman or something. But there's something about finding a natural fruit and seeing my children be so excited about it that it has an effect on me.
And that's one of the discussions I've had with my friend this summer. Myself as a gardener, I love to garden, and she has just been experiencing foraging for the first time this summer. And so we've had many discussions in terms of foraging versus gardening, and it's fascinating hearing like that innate desire. And like I love to forage as well, but I find I like the reliability of gardening, because like once the skill is there, like I can produce all my food no problem, with doesn't seem like a lot of work. But there is totally joy in going out there and finding something that you did no work for that is extra delicious and is still often very abundant.
Well, and also the feeling that if you didn't harvest it, it might go to waste, or that maybe nobody else knows about it. And so the getting to tell other people about this plant you found, like, you know, like fiddleheads is a good example, where often you're just on a walk or a hike because you want to be, and then you find a fiddlehead patch. And, you know, when they're ready to go, there's more than one person would ever need to eat personally. So you can all of a sudden tell all your friends, and there's more than enough to go around. And it's exciting to get to spread the word in that kind of a way, which is, a different conversation than my tomatoes grew in my yard that I put there. It's interesting because I feel like I hadn't really thought about the foraging versus farming until this conversation. But to me, it's like a similar appeal for why this kind of radio recording is more interesting to me, like the finding of other people's stories as opposed to running a studio and actively creating recordings, or being like, you come in and you were going to make this thing that, like, you know, that it feels like the traditional studio setting is maybe closer to the farming, the reliability, you know, what you're expecting and what you're getting and how to set it up to catch that. And then community radio, or going around with like a personal recorder and sometimes soliciting total strangers, it might, you know, not be the most effective way of getting something that you've, like, if you have something specific in mind, that's a very roundabout way to try to get it. But if you are excited to discover, it's a whole other way of doing it, right?
This is very interesting, and perhaps a different conversation, the foraging versus farming.
You a forager though, Michael? You seem like you probably would be.
Yeah, I absolutely am a forager. I've been foraging apples mostly lately to make apple cider. I've got about 8 gallons fermenting. I make an alcoholic fermented cider out of wild and gleaned apples, which is really exciting. So I relate to what you're saying about finding, because for me, I've been finding apple trees on the side of the road and that kind of thing, and it's very exciting. Although, and Ryan, I'd like to disagree. You cannot grow all of your own food, no problem. It's a lot of problems, a lot of hard work, a lot of heartbreak. There's a lot of failures, insects, diseases, blights. So, you know, you can grow most of your own food, certainly all your own veggies. You're probably not growing things like meat and grains.
I could, though.
Well, sure, but you would need the land, the money, the time.
That's true.
And a whole lot of cooperation from Mother Nature.
Well, My next project, I think, is going to be doing a TV show where I grow all my own food.
I want to be a part of that.
No,
and also
I have to do it by myself.
Oh, well, maybe I'll be camera person or
okay.
guest one day or
something. You can be my guest interviewer.
I also just wanted to say that I think farming is actually the evolution of foraging. We've only actually, as a species, been farming for 5,000 or 6,000 years or something, so evidence would lead us to believe. And before that, things were a lot more difficult, relying on on purely forage.
Totally, that's what I mean. Like, most of the stuff that you find foraging has very short window. Mm-hmm. So we've been talking about fiddleheads. So like
apples, yeah.
It's just such small windows to be able to, like, you have to. It's almost just like a little bonus, like that you can kind of supplement. But to have that as your regular food supply is just too difficult, I find. Mm-hmm. Whereas gardening, I know because I can kind of plan for it and it's been bred to be reliable. I find I can get much more sustenance from it. Mm-hmm. But the joy and the treat of foraging is very exciting.
I also think that foraging, I associate it with... you're on some sort of travel or journey, like you're on a hike, or you're going from a place to a place. And that's what it would have been like probably when you and your family would have up and rerouted constantly based on the seasons and what you had available, you know, like way, way back. And
I think,
but whereas a farmstead is very much the opposite of I've chosen this, I'm going to make this work, and I'm going to set up camp here, and I'm going to make this sustainable. And so it's a different, like, part of your spirit or something too, probably.
There's some evidence that Native North Americans used a type of agriculture that was somewhere in between agriculture and forage. So we know that people were cropping things like sunflowers, corn, passion fruits, and we squash, of course. And we suspect that people were encouraging foraging opportunities. So people were using forests. Of course, people had such a more intrinsic connection with the land than we do today in North America, but people were encouraging forests to produce nuts, herbs, by, you know, selective removal, or encourage, like, by removing sort of what we would call weeds, you can encourage, you know, a certain tree to flourish. Mm-hmm. And then people would know that they could come back and forage from that tree every year for nuts or fruits or whatever. Mm-hmm. So something like a mix of foraging and cropping. Right?
And would you say that that's what our Huron Street Garden is, kind of? A mix of kind of foraging versus cropping? Because there's a lot of perennials that are going to be there year after year, but we're encouraging the ones that we want and discouraging the ones that we don't want.
I would say that that's a very interesting point. I think what I'm referring to is more what we would today call a forest garden, which is sort of a new idea that came out of permaculture, you know, 20 years ago or something like that, where a forest is actually the garden. And as Europeans, when we came over, we couldn't see a forest as a garden in any way. It's only really now that we're starting to see how productive a forest is and how we could potentially get all of our food from a forest in the way that we do with traditional agriculture. But the Huron Street Garden, no, I would call it more of a garden.
Okay.
In that it was purposeful. And certainly for kids in that, when they're discovering, or for new gardeners, when they discover that, wow, that tree actually makes pears. That's an exciting thing that, you know, maybe is relatable, but... No, it was really definitely started by people planting things for the explicit purpose of harvesting later on.
That seems like that's something that probably, I love the idea of that coming out of observation rather than the practical planting and mending a plant seems very scientific. There's still an art to it for sure because it's unpredictable, but... the idea of seeing what happens when a particular plant is removed and having to wait till next season to see if that had an impact, like that kind of approach that you're describing of the forest garden is really fascinating to me. It seems almost like you would probably learn some of that from observing animals, right? Like how squirrels, they're annoying in the city, but they're so essential in the forest for that, just planting nuts and forgetting. That's like, you know, one of the biggest ways that things have come to exist. And so I like the idea that from watching squirrels, even probably in some cases, or other similar animals, probably a lot of those tricks were learned.
I imagine that, yeah, a lot of our knowledge was exactly that. In fact, the first rule of permaculture is observation. This is what we, if you take a permaculture certificate course, that's what they'll teach you first, is observe. And I think you're exactly right. By being in your environment and watching the wildlife, birds, mammals, rodents, you know, well, rodents are mammals, but we learn the most from other beings in our garden.
It's also such a, like, not scary, but like, imagine moving into a new house and spending a year observing, like, before you fix the roof, for example, or something. Like,
right.
Let's see where the water comes in when it's raining. Or let's, like, there's so many, we've really gotten rid of that practice in most ways. We prepare first. Mm-hmm. We replace the roof preemptively. We replace the windows. We don't spend that winter losing money on heat to find out which window's the worst one, you know. And so we've gotten rid of a lot of those instincts, or we fight them with preparation. And so it's interesting to know that there's still certain forms that the observation comes first.
Yeah, that's a really, really interesting point, and I really appreciate that, thinking about that in relation to gardening. I think that if you were talking about your garden, you would fix the roof first. If it's leaking, you would have to fix the roof immediately, just as if it was your house. If you got water coming in or a big hole, you already know that you need to fix that, so you don't need to spend a year observing. But that's the permaculture standard, is to wait a year before you do anything.
Yeah.
So it's funny that you said a year. But I guess in a gardening sense, or in a homeowning sense, if you've got something that's very broken, like a hole in your roof, you know that it needs to be patched. And maybe you spend a year or some time figuring out what roofing material you're going to use when you permanently replace it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so you know you need to patch it now. You know you need to, because you know you need to pull the bindweed now in your garden. You know you need to keep the Japanese knotroot out or down. But maybe you're going to decide, or sit on it before you decide what kind of tree you're going to plant in its place. Or, you know, again, if you're going to use asphalt shingles or metal shingles. Or
yeah. Do you spend time deciding? I know that, you know bindweed, because you know it to see it and you know its effects. You've already had more than that year of a relationship with bindweed, right? But I constantly see posts from people gardening for the first time. Like, is this a weed? Am I allowed to keep it?
Yeah.
What will be the bad? Because there's that strange, is this a weed if I like it? If it's pretty and I'm making a garden and I want to be pretty and I don't have to work on this one as much and it's more naturally inclined to exist here, what makes it a weed? And I mean,
that's an interesting question, and you're right, that's something that comes up quite a lot, more than you'd expect, where to many other people, bindweed is obviously a weed. However, it's beautiful. It's a beautiful climbing, trailing plant with, you know, trumpet-shaped morning glory-type flowers. It's gorgeous when it's in bloom. It fills lawns with lovely little flowers. You know, dandelions, if you look at them objectively, are gorgeous. They're beautiful, bright, joyful, yellow little flowers, and then they turn into these puffballs of glory that children love. I mean, they're gorgeous and fun. I think we all can agree that a dandelion is a weed. However, its merits arguably outweigh its drawbacks. Dandelions are something that is called a dynamic accumulator, meaning that its roots go so deep into the soil that it pulls minerals from the subsoil and then and creates its body out of them. And as the plant, the leaves and the flowers decompose, those minerals are transferred to the surface. So,
wow.
Yes, a weed. Absolutely, but ecologically, it's fulfilling a really important function. At our Two Rivers Garden, our Huron Street Garden, we've had members in the past who insist on keeping, you know, what I would call noxious weeds, because they don't want to kill something. And I find this, you know, I find it a little bit maddening, honestly, because I think, you know, really every time you eat a carrot, you're killing something. Mm-hmm. And as gardeners, we're, you know, it's our, we've made an agreement to maintain the garden to a certain standard. And gardening really is the control of nature. It's a human being asserting their dominance over a plot of nature. Mm-hmm. If we weren't gardening, we would have forest. We might have prairie. But basically, nature is fighting against everything, against us, to create forests. And we're paving it and pulling it and planting things and tilling it and da-da-da-da-da.
That's so interesting. I can totally relate to the not wanting to... that's what stopped me. I grew a bunch of seedlings and then, you know, read the part about pull out the weakest ones.
Mm-hmm.
And I pulled them out and I put them in another pot. Come on, you can do it. It was terrible.
I relate to that. I really do. I'm a very sensitive person and I don't want to kill things either. But as a gardener for my job, this is what I do. I have to go around and pull out weeds for people. And so perhaps I've become a little bit desensitized. But I mean, the harsh reality is that everything eats something. Plants are all carnivorous. This is something, another interesting point that not everybody really even thinks about or acknowledges, but plants in and of themselves eat decomposed and decomposing matter, which is made out of, you know, dead animals and dead plants. So I don't know. The world we live in is full of life and death and birth and rebirth and whatever. But if you're a gardener, you have to pull your weeds, you know, like your zucchini plant is going to do way better if there's one zucchini plant in the mound versus three in the mound. You'll get healthier, better zucchinis, you know. Your apples will be much healthier if you thin your apples, you know, to do something with them, compost your weeds, you know. I digress.
That's wonderful. I think, we should wrap up. Thank you for being my guests today and talking about gardening, Michael and Ryan.
Thanks, Jenny. It's been fun.
Thank you, Jenny.
We'll talk to you guys soon.
So we're almost at the end of the show. Today's show was Michael Schimpf, who is the Community Gardens Coordinator, and Ryan Ritzkes, who works for the Two Rivers Neighborhood Group. And this has been the Mobile Community Radio Show, a show where we take CFRU off the campus and into the neighborhoods. And we've been over at the Two Rivers Neighborhood Group and would like to extend a huge thank you to them for letting us stay here so long. You can tune in next Monday at 1 p.m. for more Mobile Community Radio. To take us out, I'm going to play a song that was recorded at the Two Rivers Neighborhood Group space at Tytler Public School. This was a live radio recording of Michael Schimpf, who is my guest today, and this is his beautiful song, By the Mountains. So here's Michael to take us out.
Saturday. Mountains in the heat of the summer, I've been waiting for, dreaming about arms around me that aren't there. There's so much I want to tell you about, so much I need to confess, but I don't tell you I'm sad, don't wanna tell you I'm lonely. There is no if only, what I've made for myself is this. In the city by the mountains, in
summer I've been waiting for. Dreaming about arms around me that aren't there. With my heart in my hands and truth on my lips, dreaming about arms around me. In the heat of the summer, I've been waiting for, dreaming about arms around me that aren't there.